Fi with a local U1 symmetry. All right, so the Lagrangian will be this. I have a covariant derivative. I'll have a mass term. And of course, I put in an explicit positive sign here because I want to have spontaneous symmetry breaking occur. So I want the sign of the quadratic term to be positive in the Lagrangian. Then I'll have a cubic term. Then I'll have a gauge term. OK, and then let me just write down the covariant derivative. F mu nu is just the usual F mu nu. OK, so far the setup is very similar to what we had for the global U1 case. Of course, now the only difference is that we have this covariant derivative. But we want to go through the same process of finding the vacuum expectation value by minimizing the potential. So here's the potential, minus v squared, phi dagger phi, plus lambda, phi dagger phi squared. And the minimum is the same. So I want to set the magnitude of phi equal to the square root of mu squared over 2 lambda, which I'm going to call v over square root of 2. OK, so v is the VeV. So we want to go through the same process. We want to expand the field around the VeV and just see what happens. So we'll write phi is equal to phi 1 plus I phi 2 over square root of 2. And then we'll shift the fields around the VeV. So I'll write phi 1 is equal to V plus phi 1 prime. And phi 2, so I don't need to shift phi 2, so it's just the same. So everything goes through exactly the same thing as the global case. The only difference is just the covariant derivative term. So let's just see what happens to that term. Okay, so that term is d mu phi squared. And so I have the covariant derivative, d mu plus I g a mu. And then in terms of my shifted fields, I just have v plus phi 1 prime plus I phi 2 prime over square root of 2, and then squared. So now I'll just expand this out. So I'll have a 1/2, then I'll have a bunch of stuff. D mu phi 1 prime plus I d mu phi 2 prime plus I g times v a mu plus I g a mu phi 1 prime, and then I have plus g a mu phi 2 prime, and then all of that is squared. Let's see, did I get the sign right? Don't think I did. I think that should be minus. OK, so we have a bunch of terms. and I'll expand it out a little bit more. So we have here, this will be the kinetic term for phi 1 prime. This will give us the kinetic term for phi 2 prime. Then I also have some kind of weird cross term where I have this term multiplying this term. This term multiplying this term won't contribute once I take the magnitude. Yeah, that's right. I'll have these two terms, and so that will give me plus g times v d mu a mu times phi 2 prime. Oh, that's not right. D mu phi 2 prime a mu. Then I'll have another term where I have this term squared. So that will give me a plus g squared b squared times a mu over 2. And those are all of the terms that are quadratic in the fields. But I'll have a bunch of other terms that will be cubic and quartic in the fields, but I won't write those out. OK, so the important thing is that the VEV for phi, you can see, has generated a mass term for the gauge fields here. So VEV for phi generates mass term for the photon in this theory. And that mass term is just g squared v squared. OK, so that achieves what we set out to do. We obtained a mass term for a photon, not by explicitly writing that term down, but by spontaneous symmetry breaking through the scalar field. But we're not quite done yet, because we want to put the Lagrangian into canonical form. But you can see we have this weird mixing term that mixes the derivative of one of the fields with the gauge field. And so we want to try to eliminate that term. So let's eliminate this mixing term, which goes like the derivative of phi 2 prime and then the gauge fields, because we want to put the Lagrangian in canonical form. OK, so the simplest way to do that is if we didn't expand in real and imaginary parts as we just did, but let's expand the field, the scalar field in polar coordinates. Okay, so I'll write phi as a magnitude times a phase. The magnitude will be 1 over the square root of 2 times V plus, so V is still the VEV, but now I'll have a shift in the magnitude, which I'll call H, because it will be the Higgs boson in this theory. And then we have a phase, which will be E to the I C over V. So let me try to be a little bit more explicit here. The fields are now H, so I'll just write H of X here. And e to the I c is another field divided by v. I want to divide by v so that my scalar field c still has mass dimension 1. All right. For small fluctuations in these fields, you can just expand linearly in h and c, and you get 1 over square root 2 times v plus h plus ixc plus dot, dot, dot. So for small fluctuations in the field, h and c are just the real and imaginary parts that we had before. All right. So far, so good. Next, what we can do is we have a gauge symmetry. We can perform gauge transformations. And in particular, we can just do a gauge transformation multiplying phi by a phase to eliminate this phase here. So we can make phi purely real. By a gauge transformation. So we'll just set phi goes to e to the minus I c over v times phi. So okay, this phase will cancel off this. And we'll just be left with the real parts, which is 1 over square root of 2 v plus h. All right, so this gauge transformation, or I should say this gauge in which phi is purely real is called the unitary gauge. And we also have to transform the gauge fields. So a mu will transform into a new field, a mu prime, which is just the original fields plus an extra term, 1 over g times v, d mu, xc, like this. OK, so in this gauge choice, I want to now expand out the Lagrangian. So the covariant derivative is now just d mu plus ig a mu prime, I should say it goes to this after the gauge transformation, acting on 1 over the square root of 2 v plus h. So now we'll expand out this covariant derivative term using this. So we've eliminated from the Lagrangian. And we want to expand covariant derivative term. Well, actually, we're going to expand the whole Lagrangian now. So I'll write down the entire Lagrangian. We have a covariant derivative term, which is 1 half just this stuff squared. So I have d mu plus ig a mu v plus h squared. And I should write a prime here, but let me just drop the primes. I also have the terms from the Higgs, the scalar potential. So now I have mu squared over 2 v plus h squared. For the quadratic term, I also have the cubic term, which is now lambda over 4 v plus h to the fourth. And then I also have the gauge term minus 1 quarter f mu nu, f mu nu. OK, so in this gauge choice, I'm just plugging it in, and this is what the Lagrangian is. So now I'll just expand all of these terms out some more. So the covariant derivative term gives me 1 half d mu h squared. So we have a kinetic term for our scalar field. We also have terms where I have a mu. So I'll have 1 half g squared v squared times a mu a mu. OK, so that was our mass term for the vector field. We also have terms involving a mu and h. So I have g squared times v, a mu times h. And I also have 1/2 g squared h squared, a mu. Okay, so that's expanding out the covariant derivative term. Now I'm going to expand out the potential. So the quadratic term looks like this. I have a 1/2 mu squared over 2. I get contributions to the quadratic term from both this term and this term. And so from here, I get mu squared over 2 times h squared. And here I'll have another contribution to the quadratic term, which will look like 3/2 lambda times v squared times h squared. I also have cubic terms, which just come from this. So that will be minus lambda times v times h cubed. And then I also have a quartic term from here as well, minus lambda over 4 h to the fourth. And then I have minus 1/4 f mu nu. OK? So I'm just expanding this out. So we've achieved something. We've generated a mass term for our photon through spontaneous symmetry breaking. And we've also eliminated this weird kinetic term. Yeah?
Is there a linear term as well?
There's no linear term. So there would be a linear term, but it cancels between these two contributions. And the way to see that is we're expanding around the minimum. So there's no term that's linear in H at the minimum. Okay.
So which symmetry are we breaking in this theory? A global symmetry?
No, it's the U1 local gauge symmetry. We've broken it.
Okay.
All right, so now we just recall that V squared is equal to mu squared over lambda. Is it over 2 lambda? I forget. No, just lambda. OK. All right, so I'm just going to plug in here into what I have here, simplified a little bit more. So here's the Lagrangian now. I have 1/2 d mu h squared minus mu squared h squared. So I'm just using this relation to simplify the term that's quadratic in h. I have minus 1/4 f mu nu. And I have the mass term for the photon now, g squared v squared a mu, plus some interactions. So now I can just read off what these mass terms are. So I have the mass of this scalar degree of freedom is just the square root of 2 mu squared. And the mass of the photon is just g times v. And now the interaction term is g squared v a mu times h plus 1/2 g squared h squared a mu minus lambda v h cubed minus lambda over 4 h to the fourth. Okay. So, yeah.
So V is the term that does the symmetry breaking, right, basically?
Like that's right.
Choosing a vacuum by basically choosing where we add V to. Right?
Yeah.
So in this case, since it's a local, does that mean V is also could also be written as V of X?
Yeah, it can be. So it's really similar to what we discussed before. So if we want to minimize the Hamiltonian to find a ground state, we want to set the derivatives of V to 0. So V dot must be equal to 0, and V, the gradient of V must also be 0. So in principle, you can have a vacuum expectation value for the field, it's called the classical field, that could depend on time or position, but that won't be the ground state. OK. So all I've done basically is just expand out the Lagrangian around the vacuum expectation value. But let's pause and take stock of where we are. So you can see that terms are arising in the Lagrangian that break the symmetry. So there's no symmetry in the theory if you just look at all of the terms that are allowed. However, there are relationships between the coefficients of all of these terms that reflect the fact that it came from an underlying symmetric theory. And the way to see that is that you have many interactions in the theory. There's no symmetry manifest. But the coefficients of each of those terms are described in terms of a fewer number of fundamental parameters. So all of the interactions are fixed. In terms of a few parameters. So you're free to choose which parameters you like. When we started out in the original Lagrangian, we had the gauge coupling, we had mu squared, and we had lambda. I think that's it. But you're free to choose a different choice. You could take more observationally motivated quantities like the masses of these particles. So you could choose, for example, the mass of the scalar fields, the mass of the gauge boson, and then you would need one other parameter. You could take, for example, the VEF. So that's also a valid choice of the parameters. But once you pick three parameters, you've fixed many terms in the Lagrangian, many meaning more than three. All right. We can also see what are the degrees of freedom in our theory. So we started out with a massless gauge field and a complex scalar. So we had 2 degrees of freedom here. And 2 degrees of freedom here. For a massless field, we just have 2 polarizations. But now we're ending up with a theory that is a massive gauge field, which has 3 polarizations. And we still have a scalar left over, but we don't have a complex scalar anymore. We only had the scalar parameterizing the magnitude of the field, which is just a real scalar. So we just have 1 degree of freedom. So the counting of degrees of freedom works the same. It's consistent. Both before symmetry breaking occurs and after symmetry breaking occurs, we always have 4 degrees of freedom. And you can see why it's OK that one of the degrees of freedom from the unbroken theory, which was the phase of phi, gets removed from the Lagrangian. It becomes the degree of freedom corresponding to the longitudinal polarization of the gauge fields. So the language people use is that this field, xi, gets eaten. By the gauge fields. To become the longitudinal polarization. In the case of the global symmetry, the global U1 that we did yesterday, remember we had a massive scalar field at the end of the day and also a massless scalar field, this Goldstone boson. Here we don't have a massless Goldstone boson. The Goldstone boson would be C, except it gets eaten to be the longitudinal polarization. So this is the would-be Goldstone. Okay. And then some notation. This real scalar field that's left over is the Higgs field. Okay. All right, so far so good on this. Yeah.
Since we're doing like this around like an expansion, is this an effective field theory rather than a? Because
no, it's not effective. It's still renormalizable.
And what about the other, like the whole other bunch of terms from the expansion? We're not writing them down, right?
Oh, I see. When you expand the exponential in this term, you'll have a lot of different terms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah, those,
Are they not there because of our gauge choice?
Yeah, they are not there once you do the gauge choice, but I think the question is, before you do a gauge choice, do you have those terms? I don't know, actually. I'm not sure if they're there or not. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure how to think about that. It's clearly a renormalizable theory once you start out from the original Lagrangian. So I'm not sure, it doesn't seem to make sense that if you just choose a particular basis for expansion that you'd also get a non-renormalizable theory. Okay. So we showed how to generate the mass term for a gauge boson through spontaneous symmetry breaking. We had other mass terms as well to worry about. We also wanted to generate mass terms for fermions. So why do we need this? Remember, if we have a chiral, so if we have fermions in the theory, so if psi left and psi right, the different chirality components of the fermion field transform differently under the gauge group. So under our local U1 gauge symmetry, then a mass term, psi bar psi, which is psi bar left, psi right, plus psi bar right, psi left, is forbidden. Okay. So what we want to do is show that we can also use spontaneous symmetry breaking to generate a mass term for the fermion as well. So let's use spontaneous symmetry breaking. OK, so I want to first just write down some notation. So before we had gauge couplings G left and G right for the different chirality components of the fermion. And I'm just going to write that in terms of what I'll call the gauge coupling G times a charge, which can be different for the different components. So if we have Q left not equal to Q right, We have a chiral gauge symmetry. So this quantity Q represents the quantum numbers under this gauge group. Okay, so we have different fields here. We'll have our scalar fields. We'll have the left-handed chirality and the right-handed chirality for our fermion fields. All right, so we'll have these charges. Before, we had just chosen the charge of phi to be 1. And so I'll just make that choice here just to keep everything consistent. So we'll assume that this is equal to 1. And then these things are going to be free parameters. So now the gauge transformations that we have. Phi goes to e to the minus ig times the charge times alpha, some function. And then the left and right-handed spinners look very similar. All right. So in principle, these three charges can be any number you like. Yes?
So we're saying the scalar also has the same coupling?
Yeah, so the theory that we're writing down is where the scalar and the fermions are all charged under this local U1 symmetry.
But does that a priori mean that they have the same coupling strength?
No, it's like particles having different electric charges. So for example, quarks have a fractional charge compared to the electron. Okay, is the setup kind of clear? In principle, these numbers can be anything you like. This one can be 17, this one could be 1.3, this one could be pi, any number. But if you make a very particular choice for those charges, you can write down another interaction term in the Lagrangian, which is a Yukawa interaction. So if those charges satisfy a particular algebraic relation, which is just that the left-handed charge is equal to the right-handed charge plus the charge of the scalar, then we can write down another term that's gauge invariant. This interaction is a Yukawa interaction, meaning it just couples fermions and scalars. And it has a coupling constant, which I'll call y. And the interaction is psi left, psi right, phi, plus Hermitian conjugate. OK, so this is allowed according to the gauge transformation, because once I do a gauge transformation here, I'll get e to the ig, q left minus q right minus q phi times alpha times my interaction. So as long as this quantity here is equal to 0, it's gauge invariant. So it's only true if I have this relationship between the charges. Okay. So we're going to assume that this is true and just ask what happens to this interaction after spontaneous symmetry breaking. So again, I want to work in a unitary gauge. So phi will be set to 1 over the square root of 2 v plus h. So now, what happens to our Yukawa term? So we have psi left, psi right. We have a 1 over square root of 2, and then v plus h, plus the Hermitian conjugate. So the term involving v is just y v over square root of 2. And then I'll have a psi bar left, psi right. From this term, the Hermitian conjugate will give us psi bar right, psi left. So I can pair those two up together, and I get psi bar psi. And it works the same way for the term proportional to h. I just get minus y over square root of 2 times h psi bar psi. OK. So lo and behold, we have a mass term for our fermion. So we have a mass term. So it's just equal to y times v over the square root of 2. Okay? So provided our fields have the right charges, we can write down mass terms for fermions, and then we also have mass terms for the gauge field. So let's just summarize. Spontaneous symmetry breaking can generate terms in the Lagrangian that violate the gauge symmetry. But it's not the same thing as just writing those terms by hand, because there are consequences to the fact that you had a theory that was symmetric before, and then it gets spontaneously broken. Those consequences are as follows. So not all interaction coefficients are independent. So the theory remembers that it came from an originally symmetric theory. And so there are relationships between the coefficients of the different interactions in the Lagrangian. They can be described by fewer parameters than you would naively write down if you had just violated the symmetry explicitly. The other consequence is that we have this extra degree of freedom in the theory, the Higgs fields in the theory, the Higgs boson in the theory. We have a real scalar fields, H, is left over after spontaneous symmetry breaking. So these two facts are very important. We argued before that if you just had a gauge invariant, a theory that violates the gauge symmetry, you run into problems of renormalizability. And I'm going to try to argue now that because we have these two facts, those issues go away. In the unbroken theory, we started with a renormalizable theory, okay? And what I want to try to argue is that just because we're breaking the theory spontaneously, we don't encounter the same issues with renormalizability that we did before once we break the symmetry by hand. So just to recap what the problem was originally, well, we looked at the problem from the point of view of scattering. In particular, we were looking at two fermions just scattering in this theory. And we had an issue at one loop. We encountered this box diagram, which we argued was divergent. So, I'll just quickly recap what the problem was. Remember that the gauge boson propagator for a massive gauge boson was minus I over k squared minus ma squared. And then I had eta mu nu minus k mu k nu over ma squared. So if I'm interested in studying the divergences, I was interested in the leading term in this propagator that would blow up once k becomes large. So that's this term here. And then it's divided by ma squared. And then I have the k squared from out front. All right, so the divergence, I had four gauge couplings, went like g to the fourth, d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. I have these gauge boson propagators. So that's k mu, k nu, over ma squared, k squared. And then there's two of them. And then I also have the fermion propagator. So that looks like k slash plus m psi over k squared. And then there's two of those. OK, and I made this argument last time, but I'll just make it again, that the terms proportional to k slash end up canceling out. The term that's quadratic in k slash, what I mean is the one that has k slash from here and k slash from here, ends up canceling with this diagram once I flip the propagators like this. And the reason is just that k slash will be going one way here and the other way in this diagram. Okay, so it'll just be a relative sign. That term will vanish. That was the term that was quadratically divergent. There could be a term that's linearly divergent, but that will vanish by symmetry. If I only have an odd numbers of k under the integral, that won't contribute either. And so I'll be left over with something that's log divergent, which won't involve any of these k slash terms, but it'll just come from the m psi term. So this whole thing will go like g to the fourth. There'll be m psi squared. And then I'll have 1 over ma cube, to the fourth. And then I'll be left with a log divergence, like this. OK, so that was the problematic term. But now, I'm imagining that I'm generating these masses through spontaneous symmetry breaking. And so I can plug in for these masses in terms of couplings and the VEV. So this whole thing will go like g to the fourth y squared v squared over g to the fourth b to the fourth. And then there's a log divergence. So this, the g's will cancel out, and I'll be left with y squared over v squared. Like this. OK, so I still have a divergence. But we still have this additional degree of freedom in the theory, and we have to calculate the contribution to these box diagrams if we have H propagating in the loop. So we have extra contributions. So for example, we have terms like this, where we have one gauge field and a Higgs field propagating in the loop, like this. And then there's different permutations where maybe I have H here and A here, or maybe the lines get crossed up in some way. All right, so what does this look like? So I have two G's, and I have the coupling here is the Yukawa coupling Y, so I'll have Y squared. And then I'll have a loop momentum integral. I have two Dirac propagators. So that'll just look like 1 over k slash squared. I have one gauge boson propagator. So that looks like k mu, k nu over k squared ma squared. And then I have the propagator for the scalar field. And the limit that k gets very large, that will just look like 1 over k squared. OK? So if I just think about the divergences, this thing is like 1. I have 1 over k to the fourth. D4k, 1 over k to the fourth, will be log divergent. And then in terms of the couplings out front, I have g squared, y squared, over ma squared. And if I plug in for ma, which is g times v, I just get y squared over v squared times this log divergence. OK? So of course, I'm not actually calculating anything. I'm just doing effectively dimensional analysis and counting which coupling constants appear. But the argument is that because we have this additional degree of freedom, and because the couplings are all related to each other, the divergence that appears here is exactly the same as what needs to be canceled by the divergence that occurs here. So the divergences will ultimately cancel out. Since all of the masses and couplings are related to each other. OK. And in a sense, it was kind of obvious that they should cancel out, because we started with a theory which was invariant under a gauge symmetry. The divergences are sensitive to very high momenta, much larger than the vacuum expectation value, let's say. And in that limit, where the momentum is large, it doesn't matter if the theory is spontaneously broken or not. All right? And so we could have done the calculation of these box diagrams in the unbroken theory, as far as computing the divergences. And because that unbroken theory was renormalizable we're guaranteed that no new divergences will appear from these box diagrams. Okay. Okay, so the prediction from a spontaneously broken gauge theory so if a gauge theory is spontaneously broken, we have an extra scalar H whose couplings are fixed by the masses. So for example, this scalar H has a coupling to two gauge bosons. And the Feynman rule is just 2 times I times ma squared over v eta mu nu. And we have a coupling of the scalar to fermions. Which is I times m psi over v. Okay? So the spontaneously broken theory predicts that there should be this extra scalar, this extra Higgs boson, and the couplings of that Higgs boson to any of the other fields that it gives mass to are related to the mass itself. So it's giving mass to the gauge boson, the coupling is proportional to mass. It's giving mass to the fermions, coupling is proportional to mass. So it's a predictive theory once we measure the masses of these different particles, the fermions and the gauge bosons, all of the couplings of the Higgs boson are predicted. Once we know the vacuum expectation value. All right, so we had the abelian Higgs model. We showed how to give mass through spontaneous symmetry breaking to one gauge field. In the standard model, we have 3 gauge fields that have mass, the W plus, the W minus, and the Z boson. And so we want to start to think about more complicated symmetries beyond U1. So this will be the non-abelian Higgs model. So we're going to take, in particular, SU2 gauge theory. Plus a complex scalar field, which will be in the fundamental representation of the gauge group. So it would be a doublet, which I'll write as phi1 and phi2. So it's a doublet. And each one of these components is a complex field. So the Lagrangian will be this. I'll have a covariant derivative term. I'll have a potential. And I'll have a gauge kinetic part. So the covariant derivative looks like this, d mu phi is, okay, I have a derivative, d mu And then the gauge parts will involve the generators under the gauge group. In this case, it's SU2. And then the gauge fields acting on the doublets. Okay. TA are the generators. For SU2, this is just the Pauli matrices divided by 2. And then lastly, we have the field strength tensor, d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And then because it's a non-abelian symmetry, I have this additional term like this. Okay, epsilon is just the antisymmetric tensor. Then lastly, I have the potential. So I have minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. So I want to minimize the potential. So, excuse me, this is minimized where phi dagger phi is equal to v squared over 2, where v is the square root of mu squared over lambda. OK, so the whole setup is very similar to the case of the abelian Higgs model. The only non-trivial feature is that our scalar field phi just has more components. So we're free to make a gauge transformation. Let me write it the following way. So we're going to expand the scalar fields as follows. So we're going to try to write it in similar to polar form as we did before. But now we have just more components to worry about. And so we can parameterize it in the following way. We have the exponential of TA CA over V. And then we'll have this two-component object, which is now purely real and only in the second component. OK, so I have this complex doublet, and it has 4 degrees of freedom. 2 complex degrees of freedom gives me 4. And this is just a way of parameterizing those 4 degrees of freedom. I have 3 C's, where A is equal to 1, 2, 3. And then the fourth one is this H, which will end up being the physical Higgs field that's left over. So C, 1, 2, and 3. And H are real fields. Okay. Then the last thing we want to do is we're going to go to unitary gauge by making a gauge transformation. That's why we wrote it this way to begin with. So psi, our complex doublet, will go to e to the minus I TA CA over V acting on phi. And so this gauge transformation is exactly what we would need to cancel off the part that we put out front here. So now we've just made a gauge transformation where this field is purely real, and it's only non-zero in the second component. OK, so let's stop there, and we'll continue with this tomorrow.